In 1998, the Roads and Traffic Authority commissioned Marianne Hamilton and Sue Anderson to undertake an oral history of the vehicular ferries in New South Wales. This compilation tape is drawn from over 40 hours of interview material recorded for the study. The opinions expressed in the oral history tapes and on this compilation tape are those of the people interviewed and do not necessarily represent the views of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority. We would like to thank all those who gave so generously of their time to share their memories and knowledge of the vehicular ferries. For many years, the vehicular ferries were a common way to cross the rivers of New South Wales. In fact, where you see a bridge today, there could well have been a punt or ferry at that crossing or nearby. They are an essential part of the road system in New South Wales and integral to the lives of individuals, communities and industry. Many of the ferries were originally established by enterprising farmers or local landholders. By the early years of the 20th century, control of them had passed to the New South Wales Public Works Department. In 1925, responsibility for many of the ferries had passed to the Department of Main Roads. Today, the RTA owns 14 vehicular ferries in New South Wales, and they operate on the Clarence, the Hawkesbury, the Parramatta and Murray rivers. During the last three or four decades, with the development of better roads and a comprehensive interstate highway system, many ferries and crossings have either been replaced by bridges or completely disbanded. Among those ferries no longer operating are the magnificent self-propelled steam ferries crossing between Newcastle and Stockton, and several ferries on the Hastings River. Most people seem to have memories of travelling on a vehicular ferry, either as part of their everyday life or as a delightful holiday adventure. Here is John Clifford, ferry maintenance supervisor, describing a typical vehicular ferry.
It's just like a barge type construction, just flat deck, flat size, flat bottom with tapered up each end. There's no front or back to them, you can turn them around wherever you like.
The RTA ferries are made of steel, the exception being the older timber ferry servicing the Wymar crossing on the Murray River. The structure of the steel and timber ferries differs considerably, as the steel ferry hulls are effectively a series of watertight tanks welded together, as John describes.
They're all watertight tanks, so all ferries have different amount of tanks in them, but each ferry's got its own self-contained compartment. So if it does get a leak in it, it can't sink. All bar this wooden one, there's no bulkheads. What we call bulkheads. The bulkheads go across thwart ships, and there's 4.5 bulkheads. And they're fully sealed, so you have one there. And well, the one timber one we've got, there's no bulkheads in it. So they're framed up and they're just all open. Yeah, just a hollow hull with framing in it, with deck and bottom plank and side planking. So if it fills up, that's why you've got to have more bilge pumps on them to, if anything goes wrong with them, they will go down. So there's a number of our ferries. We've got five ferries riveted hull. That would date them from about 1930 downwards. So there's one 1899, there's one 1911 and one 1919. So from about 19... probably the late 20s down to 1899.
As John indicates, the techniques of constructing riveted steel hulls come from a bygone era of shipbuilding, and gradually the skills required for this type of construction are being lost. This poses a great challenge for the maintenance and upkeep of the older steel ferries, as Martin Halley, formerly an engineer with the RTA Fleet Management Section, recounts.
Now, we had no one left in the workshop who could rivet. We only had one boilermaker who had never done heavy riveting, and certainly not on ships. It was hard enough to find somebody who could taper and bend this plate to suit. Anyway, they eventually solved all those problems, or found somebody who could do it, and then said, right, oh, they found somebody to make the plate, and it fitted. And then they got the tar paper, which used to go into the joint in between. And then they said, right, now we're going to rivet it. So they got out all this ancient riveting gear. All this stuff, this portable forge and the tongs and the old tin can that catch the red hot rivet. But nobody knew what temperature it ought to be. And they had a string of three boys that would take the rivet from the forge, take it up to another bloke, he would take it down, because you've got to have a holder upper inside. The rivet goes in from the inside. It has to, because the riveter is on the outside, so the holder upper is on the inside. He jams the rivet in the hole, puts a, what they call an air leg against it, which is an air piston. He jams it against some part of the frame, puts the other end against the rivet head and turns on the air. Holds the rivet in. The boilermaker on the outside with the rivet gun, which is also pneumatic, da-da-da-da-dang, knocks it over. So it had to get down into the hull. Now, this big ferry, the Wiseman's Ferry, had 13 compartments, and it was all divided into 13 compartments as a guard against sinking. And one of these compartments had the bad plate. The boilermaker's mate is crawling through this hull with a red-hot rivet in his tongs to hand it to the holder-upper, who is on the inside, and all this had to be done before the rivet cooled. Now, it had to remain red-hot. And nobody really knew how to do it. So there we were, fiddling around. There was about a dozen rivets to go in, only a dozen. They put in a dozen and then cut a few out to see that... Because the thing with the rivet is, when you knock it over, you can't tell whether the head is square or skewed without actually cutting it out again. Now, in the old bridge building and shipbuilding construction, they used to specify 10% more rivets than they needed, with the knowledge that probably 10% of them wouldn't be properly driven. In our case, because of our inexperience, the rivets were most often too cold, and they were loose. You could tell when a rivet's loose by tapping on the head with a hammer. If it rings, it's tight. If it makes a dull sound, it's loose. So we had to cut more than 50% of them out again and redo them because we hadn't got it right. So we went on with this, and it was... all chalked up to experience and to apprentice training and so on, because it was an extremely expensive business.
The ferries move across the river on two cables, a drive cable, which moves the ferry, and a guide cable. The cables need to be constructed to withstand a lot of wear and tear.
It's a wire rope. It's 6x7, which is six strands of wire twisted, and each one of them six has got seven strands in it. Right hand lay in each twist, and up the centre of it is a fibre core, so when it stretches there's a slight give there. Galvanised gal wire rope, and whatever particular length what crossings they vary from 500 metres to 1,000 metres.
The maintenance of the ferry fleet is undertaken by a multi-skilled team, which is headed by John Clifford. Phil Hyde, the technical support manager of the RTA fleet, outlines the ferry maintenance program.
Well, the service day a month is engine and transmission service, inspection of all electrical and safety equipment, inspection of all the rigging, inspection of bits and pieces. Then there's a three-monthly inspection that John Clifford does, and the papers are sent to the locals plus the waterways authority. And then there's a three-yearly out-of-the-water overhaul and full inspection.
The three-yearly overhaul involves taking the ferry out of the water, giving it a complete mechanical overhaul, and stripping and repainting the hull. For this overhaul, the ferries require slipping or dry docking.
Well, the ones in Sydney are done on... they're either done at their own dry dock... slip by at Mortlake. They're towed down by tugboat, positioned on the dock and towed out with a winch. In other words, they go up a dry slip, in other words, a rail ramps out of the water. Very common practice in all forms of ship repair anyway. The dry dock at Ashby is you float the vessel in and then pump the dock out. Shut the doors and pump the dock out.
The Sydney Region ferries are overhauled at the Mortlake Slipway on the Parramatta River. The slipping of the ferries at Mortlake was by all accounts a huge event that required 2 weeks' notice to local residents, police traffic control, closure of the streets leading to the ferry approaches, and, prior to the mid-1970s, required the assistance of two winches housed on prime movers. The process of slipping the ferries took place in the middle of the night in June to ensure catching the full benefit of the spring tides. In the mid-1970s, Martin Halley devised an innovative permanent winching system at Mortlake, which makes the whole process a lot easier.
The Mortlake slipway became very important. For years they had used trucks with winches behind the cabs, prime movers, with huge winches behind the cabs. And they'd run these wires out, down the slipway, out into the Parramatta River, hooked onto the ferry sitting out there, and hauled it up using these trucks. The trucks had to be jacked and braced and wedged and blocked, and it took at least a day to set them up. It used to block the road to the Mortlake ferry for most of the day. We had to have police supervision and council to close it off, and had to be announced 2 weeks in advance and all this sort of stuff. And they said, well, why can't we get some permanent winches mounted on the ground inside the slipway, which would always be there? So we said, right, we need some big winches to be mounted, two of them, up the top of the slipway. Where are we going to get them? How much do they cost? Can we get some second-hand ship's winches? So I got sent down to a shipbreaker's, and they said, go and look for these winches. I understand these blokes got some winches down at the shipbreaker's. So I went down there. He was like the Dodgy Brothers, this bloke. He was amazing. Got just what you want. Come over here, you know. And you see these dirty, rusty green things. But they were off an XANL ship that he'd broken up. And they were what we wanted. And I said, we'll take the cover plates off and let me have a look at the gears. So he took the cover plates off and he said, look, still got oil in it. So we had a look at it and we tinkered and we figured around. And I had a budget. I took a deep breath, crossed my fingers and said, right, I'll buy it. So we bought it. And delivered to the slipway. And all the time I'm thinking, oh, God, I'm not right. Anyway, we had to put foundations down for them. Now, all of Sydney is on sandstone, which is horizontally bedded, and it's always got lenses of clay and joints and all that sort of stuff in between them. If you just bolt that winch to the slab of rock and then start pulling the 200 tons, it'll just crack the rock. So what are we going to do? So the dry off has got to work. And there were boring piles, and they were making huge holes and massive foundations going down 30 feet, all this sort of stuff. They got it worked out. Each winch will be held by four piles drilled 20 feet, 30 feet down into solid rock, filled up with reinforced concrete, reinforcing cages, and then a slab cast on top, the winch mounted to the slab, everything be hunky-dory. Okay. So I order up this earth borer, this big boring machine to bore the holes in the rock. He comes in and he's going grind, 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 grind. He's getting nowhere. Obviously too small. Send him away. So I called up a bigger one. He came down and he said, oh, I said, I think I can do it. Grind, 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 grind. Another 4 hours. Still no progress. Right, where's the biggest bloody rock borer in Sydney? Send him up. So we get him up. He gets up, of course, and he's got this monstrous tall mast, and it interferes with the power lines. And that was the reason why I got the small one in the first place, because these power lines and all these restrictions. Anyway, we finally got him in, and he bought it in an hour. We installed the winches, and we ran new wires on them. Everybody was very keen to use the winches on the big one from Wiseman's, because that was always a real problem to get up on the ways. So we started up, and it was smooth as glass. It was so beautiful. It was because they had a low speed and a high speed, and they set them on the lowest possible speed, and it just whined a bit, and she came up. It's lovely. And all the local residents loved it, because it used to be trucks with engines bellowing for hours, dragging this thing up. Everybody's shouting and yelling and roaring engines and smoke. There's just a whine to Canada. Lovely.
Over the years, the North Coast vehicular ferries were overhauled at Riley's Dock on the Richmond River and the Ashby Dock on the Clarence River. Jerry Doolan, bridge maintenance planner with the RTA Grafton office, relates some of the history of the Ashby Dry Dock.
The dock is on the mainland, and it's called Ashby. The town's called Ashby there as well. Public Works would have been the people who built the dock in the first place, and this would have been in the probably 1880s. So they would have come to this river and seen a need to have a dry dock, and they would have bought land and blasted this massive sandstone dock. We took over the dry dock in I think it was about 1975, and we have continued to maintain it. Things that have changed will have been that the gates have had better hydraulic motors fitted to them. They will have had better pumps fitted to the dock. There's a an old crane that will have been built there in the probably in the 20s, 1920s. There's a funny old stiff-legged derrick crane, they call it, which we hardly use now because we just take a mobile crane in and use it. But, yeah, pretty well, fairly historic dock, actually. We're presently looking at studies to checking the whole area out for contamination. When you think that, red lead and all sorts of horrible poisons were used for keeping barnacles from growing on ferries and preserving things. We're in the process of cleaning the whole site up.
One person who still regularly uses the Ashby Dry Dock is Laurie Duff, a tugboat operator on the Clarence River.
Yeah, the problem they have there at the dry dock lately is that the silt building up in front of the gates, they can't open the gates. I've, the last couple of times, having to spend a day in there with the tug blowing the mud away from the gates. What you do is tie a rope to the shore and with the tug, and you tie it to the back of the tug and you just try and drive away. All you're doing is a propeller is thrusting, because the propeller's fairly deep down in the water on the tug, and it blows all the mud away. Just like a big fan, just blows the mud away from the gates. But the last couple of times we've had to spend a day there to blow the silt away from the gates so they can open wide enough to get the car ferries in and out. And that's what stopped them. They won't let them dredge out the front of the gates.
The process of slipping or dry docking ferries is not always straightforward. Martin Halley describes the slipping of the Weimar ferry on the banks of the Murray.
Now, the interesting part of it was that in many locations, particularly on the Murray, there was no proper slipway. They had to do it on the bank of the river, and it was done by very old-fashioned methods, or strong-arm methods. And we used to take there was one at Weimar, Speedway, the little wooden vessels, and we'd take them off the wires, tow them with a little outboard dinghy over to the slipway. Got trucks with winches, tow trucks with winches on the back. They'd actually lay temporary skids with rollers, and they'd drag the vessel up on these rollers and on the skids. But the banks of the Murray are very steep, and it's very difficult to work on a vessel when it's on a steep angle. So they ended up jacking the thing till it was nearly level, and it weighed 30 or 40 tons. And then because they used to do these maintenance things in January down there, it was always extremely hot. And at Weimar, when the Hume Dam was low, there was acres and acres of white sand, and it was as hot as hell. So they used to put these temporary shelters up, and a temporary roof and canvas and so on over the vessel to try and keep the poor blokes from dying of sunstroke. They used to stay in the local motel, which the only one close to the site was just a series of dog boxes, some of them even un-air-conditioned. So they'd stay up till late at night with all the windows up and hoping that the temperature in the room would drop, and what the blokes do when they're out on their own and it's late at night, they drink. So they used to have a fine old time.
The Murray River ferries at Speewa near Swan Hill and Weimar near Albury have been operating since at least the turn of the century. They both serve small rural communities, providing convenient access to larger towns. For many years, the ferries at Speewa and Weimar were small wooden punts. While Speewa now has a larger welded steel hull ferry, Weimar is served by a two-car timber punt. This is one of the two remaining timber ferries in New South Wales. The other services the Portland crossing on the Hawkesbury. Neville Field, former leading hand bridge carpenter, and Lalith Amawira, current ferry maintenance engineer with the RTA, describe one of the peculiarities of the Weimar crossing.
The Victorian side was a bit shallow for the ferry to beach itself properly, so you could drive vehicles on it. And we had what we call a ramp that was built to lift the traffic out further into the water so that the ferry could come up onto that jetty. And the vehicles used to drive up onto the jetty and then onto the ferry.
They used that, with the tide level, they used that jetty to take the cars loaded. The one side is real steep on the bank, the other side not real steep. Then depends on the tide level, they use that jetty sometimes to get across to the ferry. It's got six wheels on that jetty. It's like a platform, little platform with a little flap. then we want to replace that. This is fairly old, and we want to design a new one. Then I'm just going to made out from steel this time.
Are you?
And put a timber deck on it. It's easy to make and maintenance. And
well, most of the time, the jetty is easily manoeuvred. Lorraine Waite, Wymar Ferry operator, recalls a couple of hiccups in the process.
And one day I thought it was the bosses coming from Goulburn or Yass, because I heard they'd had a new green Falcon. And I hooked up and forgot to... till I realised it wasn't him, and I just shut the gate, and probably in relief and forgot to unhook it, I don't know. And I towed in about 200 feet, but it didn't sink properly, so I pushed it back and I set it back up on the rails with a neighbour across the river came down with his tractor and got it back. And then about 3 hours later, Peter Andrews did turn up and he never noticed that it was off the rails.
The RTA ferry teams are not only involved in maintenance and repair, but have also undertaken a number of ferry design and construction projects. Martin Haley recalls the design and construction of the new Speewah ferry.
The ferry itself was too big and heavy, really, to carry by road, and that cost was quite large, and they were afraid that the weight was too much for some of the bridges along the road, so we had a design problem. So they thought, right, we'll make it out of pontoons, separate tanks which you clip together on site. Each tank can be carried by road, we'll take them there, clip it all together, all the accessories will come by truck and the whole thing just be bolted together on site. Fantastic idea. But there's a few things I forgot. They built the ferry with slab ends, square ends. Now, the Murray is so shallow that you can actually ground that bottom corner of the slab end 20 yards from the shore. So they had to modify the approaches. But another thing they did was put swim ends on it. That is, they put tapered ends. They bolted extra pieces onto these pontoons, which had ramps on them. So that extended your reach.
Another big RTA project, remembered with particular pride by John Clifford, was the remodelling of a ferry from Wiseman's for the Bluff Point crossing on the Clarence River in the early 80s. The Wiseman's ferry was towed to Yamba for the rebuild.
They wanted a bigger crossing, a bigger capacity ferry at Bluff Point. So we towed it up there, set it up, cut it in half, and there's a local firm called Yamba Welding and Engineering constructed or fabricated a new section, 12 metres by the width, or 10 metres by whatever depth it was. And we just dropped it in two sections. We got it built in, like the 12 metre section was built in two sections, so we put two of them down together and welded them up. It was a hydrostatic drive at the time, so we converted it back to a mechanical drive. And we just made a bigger ferry. It was a very interesting job, actually. It brought back a bit of boat building that I hadn't done for a while.
As John mentioned, ferries are often towed at sea, and this is not always a straightforward process.
They usually strap up alongside, like tie up alongside the ferry, and go out through the harbour or down the rivers. And once they say they come down the Hawkshire, they get out the pit water there, then they just have the rope on and they just keep snigging around and let them drop back. And when they get up the heads here, I just let it come up, they just let it go, and they come up alongside and they push her in. They tow it, once they get out the sea, they tow it on 600 foot of rope. Couldn't be close, because if it went down, it'd just pull the tug down. See, 600 foot, it gives them enough time then to let everything go and just let it go. The small ones are like a cork, they go up and down with the waves, but the big one, like the big, this size for the 15 cars and probably the big one, well, they go over one wave and then through the next. They go over, if the seas are big, and just plough straight through the next one and go over the next one.
The Hawkesbury River ferries were also regularly towed from Pittwater down the coast to the RTA's Mortlake Slipway in Sydney. As ferry maintenance men with the Hawkesbury Council, Dennis Mitchell and Volker Helms, explain, Wiseman's Ferry on the Hawkesbury is one of the oldest and most important vehicular ferry crossings in New South Wales.
Yes, that was started by Solomon Wiseman. He was in charge of the convicts down there at the time when they built the old North Road. He ran an inn down there and he started the crossing there for putting people across and cattle across.
The first crossing, it was more or less, it started from where they went with a rowing boat and the cattle had to swim behind it.
Yeah.
And they had a bank on each side where the cattle actually could get out. That was the original crossing. Mm. The people, they rowed over, and if they had big cattle herds coming down, being out west into the country or the north, they had to swim behind the boat, or they herded them with 2-3 boats.
Yeah.
That's how the crossing started. Yeah, and that was the main road from Sydney to up north, Newcastle and Abbey.
Yeah.
The main road inland from Sydney went over Weisman's Ferry long before Hawke's Bay River at Brooklyn.
As well as the crossing being of such importance, the current Weisman's Ferry is also of historical interest.
Like Weisman's Ferry, what is the biggest one in the state, I think, it was original on steam, and you can still see where the coal bunkers were and where the steam boilers is all converted to diesel. Where it's still a riveted hull. Came from a sugarcane country from up north. So I don't know exactly which crossings. And they used it there for the sugar. I think the sugarcane trains actually went on the ferry to the from the fields to the sugar refinery.
And the tracks on it.
Perhaps one of the most renowned events in the history of the Hawkesbury River vehicular ferries was the huge flood of 1978. Martin Halley recalls the events of 3 wet days in March and begins his account as he reaches Webb's Creek crossing and sees a ferry drifting on the broken cable.
The river's roaring. There's whole trees coming down the river, bashing into the ferry, rolling underneath the hull and popping out the other side. The cables are strained, you know, and it's obvious why he couldn't pull the ferry into the shore, because the end guides had shattered.
Martin then set off to get bulldozers and tow trucks to assist in salvaging the ferry. Russ Mitchell, former head of ferry maintenance with the Hawkesbury Council, stayed on board to keep an eye on events as they unfolded.
He was a classic character, maintenance man of the Hawkesbury Council. A really tough, energetic man, larger than life. And he was on board this thing. And he's watching the cables, and he's watching what they used to call the king posts, which are the posts on each bank to which the cables are attached. Now, they're council property. They're very expensive to install, very expensive to replace. Cables are nothing much, but the posts are important. So he's sitting there waiting for something to happen. At last, the bulldozer arrives, just coming down the hill in his Lolota, and the bloke on board the ferry says, "The king posts are pulling out, I'm cutting the cable." So he burnt through the cable with his torch, thing took off down the road.
The Webb's Creek ferry drifted down the Hawkesbury River with Russ Mitchell aboard. When it reached the Weisman's Crossing, it collided with the main Weisman's ferry and the relief ferry moored at the crossing. The ferries broke loose and all 3 ferries began their epic 3-day journey down the Hawkesbury River. There were more council workers on board the Weisman's ferry, and at this stage, the 3 ferries were tethered together in the hope that they could be stopped. Martin describes one such attempt to stop the ferries.
By sheer chance, they drifted around this big bend, and they happened to drift into the calm area. You know, the current always sticks to the outside of the bend. They drifted to the inside. And the bloke on the Webb's Creek ferry, the strong, resourceful fella, threw a rubber around a tree, and somehow managed to get off the ferry, round to the tree and back onto the ferry and tie the thing up. And he stopped it. And for a minute, they were okay. And everybody said, "Oh, beauty, emergency's over." But somehow during the night, the other 2 got away. I don't know how that happened. I can't understand it. But the 2 big ones became disconnected from the Webb's Creek ferry, which was tied up, and they took off down the river again. So we came down and we hopped in a dinghy and we went zooming down and we saw the Webb's Creek ferry. No damage, everything's fine. The 2 blokes aboard are happy as Larry, they're staying there in order to stop vandals coming aboard and wrecking the thing, and mind you, picking up the odd fridge that floats past, and they had their baskets full of watermelons which had come down from the... having a great time.
Now from a reverse perspective, travelling up the river from Pittwater to meet the ferries was tugboat operator Laurie Duff, who had been called in to stop the ferries before they reached Peter Island Bridge. There was great concern that if the ferries crashed into the bridge piers, they may have collapsed under the impact. By this stage, the ferries and all the debris that had collected under them was estimated to have weighed 650 tonnes.
the seas were mountainous. We were into big swells off Palm Beach inside Pitwater at the time. Now we headed out to sea because we had to go out to sea to run into the swell before we could turn around and come back upriver. And I was losing sight of the other tug. He wasn't that far behind me. He was just disappearing out of sight. That wasn't so much the problem. It was what was coming down the river in the dark towards you. Logs, caravans, trees, everything. You couldn't see until you were sort of right on top of it.
Laurie sighted the ferries at Spencer and made his first attempt to stop them near Barara Creek.
Yeah, I lashed up alongside one car ferry, and I was getting myself in position, and it spun around, and I was on the inside of it. I went to let go to pull away, but when I went to go astern on the tug, it stalled. There was a log or whatever jammed into the propeller. It just stalled the engine. Oh, this is nice. And I was on the inside of everything, being pushed towards a sheer rock cliff. I thought, oh, we're finished before we even start here. And I ordered the two deckies off the tug onto the bars, and where I was, sort of up in the wheelhouse, I could have jumped the last minute before we hit the rocks. And I kept trying to start it. And eventually it did start. We couldn't do anything with them, all but steer them. And what our plans were to tow them down into the entrance of Barara Creek, Barara Waters there. And I was, had one tug alongside pushing, and I was shepherding the whole lot, steering around the bends in the river and that type of thing. And my plan was, as we got towards the mouth of Barara Waters, to come and pick up the tow line off the small council boat, and for me to start pulling with the other tug pushing, and get enough momentum to drag it in out of the floodwaters. But at this crucial point where I went up to pick up the tow line, the police boat come along and unfortunately tangled the tow line around the propeller. And the last chance I had was to push them in above the top of Pete Island where the mental asylum is. And I said to one of my deckhands there, I said, well, once if we get to the shore, just run a rope around a tree and just hold and just play it like that and just feed it out. Without taking, snapping the rope and breaking type thing. You know, I pushed it right across the rocks on the top of Pete Iron, and there's smoke, and then they come out. He says, it's fairly dramatic. That tug at the time had rod and chain steering, which big heavy chains run down either side, and rods, steel rods, it still had the original steering in it. It was heavy. And I never, because you really had to put your shoulders into to spin the wheel all the time. I don't know how many thousand times I spun the wheel from one lock to the other. I never felt it then, or it wasn't until the next day. Back, shoulders just starting to ache for days and days after. Just that I never felt it at the time because you're too busy, and I never ever experienced anything like it again.
Of course, floods happen on all rivers. Laurie Clifford, who operated several Richmond River ferries, talks about his experience of floods.
And I've seen times out there that there was so much debris coming down that river, if you happen to get caught out in the river, I don't know what had happened. Because you can't go, it'll stop you. Trees, logs, hyacinth, pieces of banks that wash off. One instance out there, I pretty nasty experience. The logs caught the ferry out in the river. Couldn't get in, we were out in the middle of the river. And we had this little boat that the fella used to tow it down. And around these logs that were on the wire, there was an eddy that deep, big hole, you could look down in it. And this fella made two blokes get out in the rowboat and try and get the logs off. And they lost their oars. The boat was rocking. Geez, I was frightened.
The New South Wales vehicular ferries played a crucial role in the road transport network. This is particularly the case with the North Coast ferries, where, for example, the Clarence River ferries provided a means of crossing the river on the main north-south highway right up until the late 60s. Terry Doolan, bridge maintenance planner at RTA Grafton office, describes the geography of the Clarence River Delta.
The Clarence River's the biggest river on the eastern seaboard of Australia. At Grafton, I was saying before, it's 800 metres wide. It's a massive river. There are 99 islands in the Clarence River up until 10 years ago, and now there are 100. Probably 20 or 30 have cane growing on them or vegetables growing on them, and the only way to get the produce to land was to do it by some form of boat or ferries. So there are a lot of farmers who run ferries to their islands privately in the Clarence River. Wherever there are bridges on the island or on the river, there used to be ferries, and a lot of the islands are populated. A lot of them have towns on them, and there would have been ferries to all those islands. But there are umpteen ferries on the Clarence, probably 30 or 40 ferries operating around the turn of the century, and some council, some private, and some state-owned.
The cane industry has had a long history on all the North Coast rivers. Cane, grown on the farms, was transported to refineries in the area on cane barges right up until the late 70s. Ray Wedgwood explains the changes in the cane industry and the impact on the North Coast ferries.
The sugar cane used to be brought down from the where the cane was grown by little railway lines, little railway tracks, and they used to cut across the highway and down to the river, either the Clarence or the Richmond or the Tweed, and then it would go on barges down the river to the sugar mill. And I don't know when it was, through the 60s, I guess, early 70s, the mode of transport changed, and instead of transporting the cane by the little trains and the barges, it started to be transported by semi-trailers. And you'd see they'd have spots by the side of the road where the cane would be in big containers, which open containers, which would be put on the semis and carted. And one of the things that I got involved with then professionally early in my career was the Bluff Point ferry. The flaps on the end of the ferry where it rides it up onto the road broke, and it turned out that it was the cane trucks transporting the cane at low tide. Because of the change in grade as it came down onto the ferry and over the flap, the triaxle at the back taking the load, which would legally have about 20 tonnes on it and probably illegally was more highly loaded, two of the axles lifted off. So all the load went through one axle onto this flap, and the flap broke. So we had to redesign the flaps for this ferry, and it was what we ended up with was a bit like the front end of a battleship, but they never broke again.
There are also many vehicular ferries on the Richmond River. Mari Newman, local historian and author, recounts the history of the river and the steam-powered vehicle ferries.
William Abbsley came to Corakai in 1849 and he built up a big shipping business. Strangely enough, a young American built up a very successful shipping business on the other side of the river. His name was Jaeger. You know, they were trying to get a ferry service, a government-funded or part locally funded service, but there's no exact record of when that began operating. But in William Yabsley's diaries, you can see that such a service started operating probably in the 1870s, because he built and launched a ferry in August 1879. Those little early ferries seemed to be hand-operated ferries, and it wasn't until September 1910, that a steam ferry built in Ballina went into operation.
Steam ferries were the precursor to diesel ferries on most New South Wales crossings. Edith Dobbin and Margaret Schweitzer, Clarence River residents, recall the old steam ferry at Harwood.
The workroom, or the, what would you call it, the
engine
room. Or the cabin.
The cabin.
All the brass clocks and all the time clocks were brass, and they were polished to the nth degree. All the steam pipes were covered with rope and painted white, and it was kept in immaculate condition always. And the puntman with his beautiful
Brass oil can.
Brass oil can.
Absolutely
oiled every trip.
Every trip
we used to oil the cogs and the wheels, and now when you look at them and you go across all clogged up, you could nearly scrape it off with a knife.
The water supply to the steam ferries at Harwood came from our farm. And I can remember the deckhand man would ride his bike from the ferry out over the out to Highfield. Here we grew up knowing them as the government wells. And we sort of always, as children, we would get on our little bikes and go with the puntmen out to the government. They were known as the government wells. They're still there. They're huge. And that was the water supply for the Harwood Ferry.
The timber were all set-size logs, and they were had a contract and were brought in, and there were always great stacks of these sizes of timber, and they'd be taken onto the ferry by wheelbarrow by the ferryman.
And Jack the Russian, I can't remember, I don't know what his name was, but Jack the Russian was one of the contractors. He was an old man that used to frighten us as children, but he used to load the his dray up with these set-size logs and take them into the wood supply of the Harwood Ferry there.
But it was, they were immaculately kept, and if cattle went over, it was all hosed down and in beautiful condition. Always. Harwood was a beautifully kept set-up.
One can tell from the way Edith speaks that people regard the ferries, or as some people call them, the punts, as an essential part of their everyday lives. Ruth McCauley, Margaret Schweitzer and Richmond River local Murray Newman share their memories of the ferries.
In my childhood years, I knew it more as a punt. It was always either the quarter to or the quarter past punt that we'd get to go to town.
Always ferry to me.
It just governed the life. You had to either go at quarter to or the quarter to or the quarter past punt to come to town, and it was either the half past or the hour that you went home. You know, if you came to town at all, then the only way to get here, get to McLean, was by the ferry. So that you sort of, if you didn't want to wait for a long time, you ran your... organised a trip to leave so that you'd be there in time to catch the ferry.
Because sometimes it'd take them a long time to walk down and start her up if they were going to have a smoke or a cup of tea or something like that.
Yeah. And also the Goodwood Ferry was operated with one, or several puntmen, operators at the local fruit and veggie shop. He had local fruit and vegetables on board, and as the people went across the ferry, they did their shopping as well.
That was very handy.
It was very handy. It was always fresh.
Especially to the outlying areas that were a long way from McLean, because you really only came to McLean if you had to do important business in that time. You just didn't come up for the day shopping.
That was another fun thing. When in prawn seasons or good fishing times, the ferry had to come in rather quickly. This is Harwood. And there were quite big bream and prawns, and you'd run down onto the flat and you'd pick up your bream and you'd pick up your handfuls, and we'd just walk home. They don't do it. No.
We used to do that on occasions at the Goodwood Ferry's kids.
Get all these prawns and these nice big bream.
At the particular time of the year, you know, when the prawns are moving.
Dad took us malleting on the hopping on the ferry once with the torches and in the mullet season. It's called mullet hopping, and people don't believe us about mullet hopping, and I know of two fellows who still do it. You get a torch and you shine it into the river, and the torch attracts the mullet, and the mullet used to jump up onto the flat as we're going across to Harwood and back again.
We went to live in North Woodburn, which I referred to, and I must have got it from somewhere, as the wrong side of the river, because you had to cross the ferry all the time. You know, whenever you wanted to catch it, it always seemed to be on the other side. And that's what creates these wonderful little anecdotes that I love about the ferry, because all sorts of things happen to people when they miss the ferry. especially men, you know, who go back to the pump for another beer or miss the next one as well. And people used the ferry in all sorts of ways. You had parcels put on the ferry. You know, you would ring up from home and say, give your meat order, and the butcher would run down and put on the ferry, and then you would walk down to the ferry and collect it.
The Murray River ferries are also warmly regarded by the local community. The ferries continue to provide a convenient alternative route for local residents and farmers to Albury and the Swan Hill, Speewa areas. The Murray River ferries are becoming a popular tourist attraction, as Lorraine Waite reflects.
The ferry is a novelty to tourists, isn't it? People, there's a caravan park about 15 miles down there, a little caravan park on the water. When the weir's up, there's a lot of people. They all just come up just to go across the ferry. I'll get calls from Wagga or Holbrook and making sure I'm open, because they just love to come across. The locals fight desperately to keep it. I mean, it's the quickest way to get to cattle markets and that, because they're at Bandiana, and it's necessary, really. Even though there's probably only 20 families, but on this side, I mean, even the ones from Grania, they use it to go to sales across at Wagga or things like that.
Even in Sydney, up until the late 1970s, ferries offered crucial links in the road transport system. Ray Wedgwood recalls his last crossing on the Lugano Ferry in 1974.
We never used to use the Lugano Ferry much, but we used to use it annually when we'd go on our great Christmas tree hunt. And we'd go out on the Lugano Ferry and across up into the area around Lucas Heights and go into the scrub there and had a special saw. We'd fell our Christmas tree and bring it home. And one day we went down to do it, and it just happened to be that was the week when they were giving out the special some special certificate to be the last person to ride on the Lugano Ferry.
Brian Pearson, former Department of Main Roads Chief Engineer Bridges, recalls the importance of the Hastings River ferries.
Our ferries comprised the crossings at Blackmans Point over the Hastings River on the Pacific Highway and the crossings at Smithtown, Jerseyville and Kinchula on the Maclay River. All these ferries were subsequently replaced by bridges in accordance with DMR policy. The running of the ferries was done by our employees and not by contract. That's the ferries for which we were responsible on the classified road system. The personnel attached to the ferries were good people, but they always seemed to be in strife. If they fell asleep at night, and an irate motorist eventually got the ferry across by ringing the bell, quite often a fight ensued. That was not uncommon, and a battered ferry driver would appear in the office next morning and ask for sick leave. For many reasons, including that sort of situation, the department decided that where possible, ferries should be operated by contract.
During the early years of the 1980s, Brian was also closely involved in the federally funded program to replace council-owned ferries with bridges.
One interesting fund that I controlled as the Chief Engineer Bridges was a fund to replace council-owned ferries with bridges. This fund came from federal money. Commonwealth financed the scheme, and it ran for several years, and in that time we replaced quite a number of council-owned ferries with bridges. I had to prepare a priority list of ferries in the order in which they should be replaced by bridges, and various factors were taken into account to prepare this priority list. One was the cost of the bridge. Where only short bridges were required, those ferries were put up in the priority list for replacement. The other matter was the amount of traffic the ferries were carrying. If the ferries were carrying a lot of traffic, then their replacement
was of higher priority than, say, a ferry carrying a small amount of traffic. The funds would have finished about the mid-80s. The policy of the DMR regarding its own ferry was definitely to replace the ferries with bridges, as funds permitted. With regard to council ferries, we helped the councils with the federally funded scheme until that scheme finished. And we didn't get as many bridges done as we'd hoped. So replacement was at a slow rate.
Many of the ferries were unable to cope with the increasing volume of traffic during the 1950s and 1960s, particularly during holiday periods. An often remembered occasion was at Harwood in 1954.
And then the delays with the Harwood ferry with the build-up of traffic. You know, for important occasions, like when the Queen visited Casino, the traffic was lined back to the Serpentine Bridge.
Would be that. Oh, it was further than that. It went out to Tabby Mobile.
So we were taught like hours.
Yes, hours.
Oh, yes. 3 hours. Multiple hours. It was the next day. Some of them got home.
And the queue that at Christmas time for the holidays at the Harwood Ferry would go back to Farlow's Lane. But because we lived just beyond the ferry on the Amber Road, Mum would drive past there and they'd say, "Get into the queue, don't go away." And we'd just say, "We just live down there." And that was sort of back at least 3 miles up to Farlow's Lane. And they're going on holidays north.
The lives of the ferry operators are folklore in some areas. Bill and Cheryl Brooks, Tony Edwards, Laurie Clifford, Lorraine Waite share some of the memories of their lives as operators.
Yeah, you'd always get that ferry stare, you know, and even when you moved into another house, you'd always have that ferry stare. I think it took about 5 years to grow out of it. Wishing out the windows for cars, looking to see if there was a car at the ferry. We were sitting in the lounge room, everywhere we go up. You'd have people there sitting around visiting you, they'd end up looking for you because they'd be all going like that too for cars. But it'd be like having dinner with somebody and then you just have to get up and go and get the car because it pulled up. There was no rest for you. It was rain, cold.
I liked it, yeah, but it's long hours, 7 days a week. And so on your own, you're tied up there for about 14 hours a day in the summertime. You've got no way of getting to town to do shopping. You can't leave the place with no one around.
Originally, when we worked Wardell Ferry, we had a boat, we had a rowing boat. The only foot passenger we were allowed to take on the ferry were the nuns. These nuns used to come down to the ferry, see, and they used to want to come over, and they asked me would I take them for a row in the boat, see. I said, no, I'm not allowed to. And if he saw me taking a foot passenger over in that ferry, and not rowing him over in the boat, look out, boy. And I said to them, I said, well, he reckons that it's dangerous because you've got your habit on, you could easily get tangled, see? And they said to me, they said, it doesn't matter, if we fall in, we can swim out. I said, I hope you can because I can't get out. Anyhow, I kept asking him, and he said, all right, he said, but make sure it's high tide. I took them for a row in the boat, and they were so excited. He said, how'd they get on getting out of the boat? I said, mate, they're as agile as a cat. I said, they flew out like birds.
One particular time, there was this couple kept coming over here and they were photographers but bird watchers and I liked them and I invited them to stay one night and Alan and Neil were horrified. Well, they come back for years. In the end, they went up to our farmhouse when they'd come back. One year, there were 3,000 bushpikes came through and they were with some big rally for some charity. They didn't all use the ferry. I think I only had 97 come over. They all come from waterers. There's no shop. And I knew they were coming, so I'd ice them. But they're all fun. They're lovely people, you know. You get a postcard from ministers and priests and people from overseas and that. But often I'll have them in for a cup of tea. Not a lot of them, but you tend to know on first appearances if you like them and can trust them and that. I've only ever had one theft here in 11 years and that was on the ferry one night.
There have been some tragic events and many amusing incidents witnessed by ferry operators and users.
the relieving ferry sank on the 26th of January 1951. There was a cyclonic storm on. It resulted in a big flood. And I went to the window and looked down at the ferry from where we lived, which wasn't very far, and it just tipped and went down. Couldn't believe my eyes. Bill McCormick had collected a whole lot of cattle from a farm down the river to put on the ferry. Now, all those people along the north side, around the Kilgan area and Buckendean and that, they flooded very badly in those big floods, and they almost all owned property out the Pacific Highway, and they would all want to round up their cattle and get them across the ferry as soon as possible and drive them out there when it looked like a flood. That it wasn't the usual ferry, which was a much bigger ferry. It was a small relieving ferry. And Bill got his cattle, and he and another young man that he had working for him, they drove these cattle onto the ferry, and on the ferry as well was a Mr. McGregor, who was a ferryman, but he was off duty. And in the cabin was a lady from just up the road who worked in the post office. His name was Mary Robinson. Angus Arthurson from Corakai was the ferryman. Now, they told Mary to shut the door into the cabin because of all the cattle on the ferry. And with the pouring rain and the wind coming from one direction, the cattle all ran to one corner and the ferry tipped and went down. They weren't a long way from the shore, and Bill relied on his horse to swim him to shore, which it did. And Angus Arthurson was able to swim to shore, but you see, Mary didn't get out, so she was drowned.
Grandparents with their grandchildren went on the ferry, and the grandfather went out and talked to the driver while the car was standing on the ferry. And if somebody touched the handbrake, this has never really been established, and the car rolled forwards and went through the gate, and in them days the gate didn't have the same safety hooks we got these days, and the gate sprung open and the car went in front of the ferry, and the grandfather went after it, and they all drowned.
Well, we even got a scare there one day on the Lurgurina. And they got a phantom phone call that there was a bomb planted. So we rush into Stockton's side there. We yell out the toll collector, open the gate and everything there, and he couldn't make out, well, Bobby Watson, I think. He's coming down right down the end of the ramp. He said, I can't hear you, can't hear you. And the boys yelled out from the bridge. And we raced around to the driver and said, there's a bomb on the boat. Get off as quick as you can. But we're down. They were taken off in top gear, they were. Yeah, that was a bum spear.
Day may seem the same, but it's always something makes it different. All the fishing at the river, right? And you got a phone call from the police.
Oh, yeah.
To tell these.
Yeah, I was up at the house and they were down at the river. And I got a phone call from Swan Hill Police. And they said they had a stolen vehicle heading in our direction, and could we obtain them until they got there? Right, we had Moolamine coming from New South Wales side, and Swan Hill were behind them. Anyway, by the time I got down to the ferry, this stolen car was already on there. So I sort of had to try and get on to the ferry and grab Bill as he was opening up the gate, and sort of told him that the car was stolen and that the police are on their way from both directions, and that we had to keep them on there for as long as we could. So, he was lucky that he had a couple of friends and they were fishing, so they were on there as well.
Fishing from the ferry, very handy.
Yeah, so, they were armed with a big shifter or something.
Jumped out the car. Yeah, we just stopped in the middle and said, you'll go anywhere, suckers. And then when we saw the police pull up the other side, we took them across.
Yeah. They had to drive off. They had no option. There was no turning around.
Put them at their place of destination. They were facing towards the police. Now you go.
Well, I know a lot about the Ashby one because I used to cross it every morning on my way to work to Ashby Dock. At one stage there was only one rope on the ferry, the driving rope. They couldn't have two because there was a lot of rock and that down below, and the rope would catch on it. Two would catch, well, it could sink the ferry, so they only had one rope. And one day the rope broke, and the operator immediately threw the anchor over the side. He didn't have the other end tied on. So the ferry's drifted down the river, and the anchor's gone. He lowered the boat and jumped in it, and it had no oars, so the ferry was on its own.
It's just so funny to see a ferry drifting down the river with a load of cars on it.
So you were actually on the ferry?
Yeah, it was loaded up with cars.
And it was floating down the river?
Yeah, because it only had one cable on it. So I said it'd last a couple of more days. We didn't want to put it on before Christmas anyhow. It didn't last to Christmas Eve, but that was it. The bloke said to Ray, will I throw the anchor out? And he threw the anchor out, but it wasn't tied on the other end. The anchor's still there. This day, I think, prawn trawler come towed it into the bank. There was no danger or anything.
The first day we got the job, there were no floor coverings, nothing here, and we were bringing stuff backwards and forwards, and it was Easter on the Good Friday. And on the Easter Saturday morning, I walked over to that door, the window there, and I looked out, and I saw a car driving around in the water. I thought, I must be seedlings. I'm not telling them I saw that. So I never said anything, and I went and made them sandwiches, and David came in real excited. He said, did you see that amphibious car out there in the river? In the weir? I said, by crikeys, I'm glad you saw it too. I said, I thought I was seeing things. So that was funny. There's a chap local that's got one of those amphibious cars, and he often races me across this chap. When it's full, Peter will beat me by miles because the ferry doesn't go as fast as that. And another day I had people on the ferry in two cars. We're all talking. Peter comes down the hill and he goes straight in the water. Well, there's a man on the ferry. He let a scream out of him. He said, someone's brakes have failed. You know, it was just Peter diving in to come across. I was honestly thought I was seeing things. I was in the horrors or something.
While today there are only a small number of vehicular ferries still operating in New South Wales, they continue to serve local communities and are increasingly becoming popular tourist attractions, providing a nostalgic reminder of a more leisurely pace of life.
The vehicular ferries were a great meeting place because they had a line drawn across behind the cabin, and for morning going to work, that from that line back to the flap was completely filled with bicycles. I mean, it didn't cost you anything to ride your bike across because you're a vehicle. And, of course, you'd line up there 5 minutes before the punt was due in, and you'd talk to all your mates and you knew everybody. And then when you got on the punt, you yarned all the way across. And it was a great meeting place. But once the punt stopped, you lost that personal touch with other people.
The ferries actually add a degree of atmosphere to the place. If you've ever been at the Barara Ferry Crossing on a Sunday when it's, you know, a nice sunny day, it really adds to the character of the place. Most people go there for a nice Sunday outing, and just hopping across the ferry and going to the other side, just as I said, adds atmosphere to it. The majority find ferries a source of annoyance because it's a slow way of getting to where you want to get to. But I think when you sit back and think of it, it's an interesting part of history of New South Wales that people tend not to think about until it's actually gone.
Even though I always loved the ferries, they were always a friendly thing to me because their chains would clank in the night time and it was just a friendly thing. And then if you were confined to bed with any sickness or anything, you could always look through the window and see everybody going and coming across the ferry. It was good. As a child, it was always a friendly thing to me. Yeah. And my family always used to say they'd never see a bridge in their lifetime. No. And it was, you know, an absolute, an amazing event. to see such a huge expanse of water so successfully achieved by having the bridge built. I think everybody was really terribly grateful for the bridge because it became such a nightmare.
Down at the highway there
to get across.
It almost created a lifestyle change. No longer did you have to plan a trip to town. You could just decide and go.
We crossed the river. It was grand, that tiny ferry worked by hand. We thought that it was fairyland, our first ride on the ferry. 1906, we could not know just how that tiny craft would grow, how often we'd go to and fro on our commodious ferry. On show days packed in like sardines or like a pod of lima beans, I never will forget those scenes when crowded on the ferry. In flood times, ferries could not go. The river all did all overflow. To cross the stream, you must now row. We could not use the ferry. The hyacinth, a sight to see, but what a press it proved to be. The floods came, pushed it out to sea, no more to plague the ferries. We talked a lot as we did wait, just listening for the opening gate, and late for church, as sure as fate, had we just missed a ferry. A happy day to everyone, blue skies may softly shine the sun, a new era has begun, and farewell to the ferry.